During the course of this presentation, you will, from time to time, be asked to stop the tape and to answer questions. You should, therefore, have paper and pencil ready before you begin to listen. You will also be referred regularly to the book of reaction schemes that accompanies this cassette. Each of these schemes is numbered, and reference will be made to a particular scheme by quoting its number. As some of the questions you will be asked are answered in this set of reaction schemes, I suggest that you cover up schemes beyond the one currently being referred to with a card or with a sheet of paper. The whole point of this type of presentation is that you should be able to follow it at a rate that suits you. Don't hesitate, therefore, to stop the tape if you want to think about something, to consider a reaction scheme in detail, to refer back to a previous scheme, or for any other reason. Equally, don't hesitate to turn the tape back, using the rewind control, if there's a section that you haven't understood properly or that you would like to go over again. Now, this cassette has been prepared by Dr. Peter Sykes of the University of Cambridge and is entitled Radicals and Their Reaction Pathways. Now, here is Dr. Sykes.
On this cassette, I'm going to talk about radicals and about some of the reaction pathways in which they are involved. Most of the common reactions in organic chemistry involve intermediates that are polar in nature. These intermediates are produced, as you can see in Scheme 1, by breaking covalent bonds in such a way that both electrons of the bond go either to one or to the other of the two atoms originally bonded together. The result, in either case, is a pair of ions, closely associated with each other in what is called an ion pair. In both examples in Scheme 1, carbon is one of the two bonded atoms. If this carbon atom loses both electrons, then the result is a carbonium ion, whereas if this carbon atom retains both electrons, then the result is a carbanion. The movement of an electron pair is generally represented, as in Scheme 1, by a curly arrow. The tail of this arrow indicates where the electron pair has come from, and the head of the arrow where the electron pair is going to. But is there any other way in which the CX bond in Scheme 1 could be broken? While you think about this, stop the tape. As you can see in Scheme 2, there is another way in which this bond can be broken, by the two originally bonded atoms, each taking one of the two electrons from the bond. The result is a pair of species, neither of which carries a charge. This type of bond breaking is called nonpolar or homopolar fission. The resulting species, each carrying an unpaired electron, are called free radicals, though the free is now commonly dropped and they're just called radicals. You'll see in Scheme 2 that I've again used curly arrows to indicate the movement of electrons, but this time I have to represent the separate movement of two single electrons, so I have to use two curly arrows, but I've given each of them only a single barb. These arrows are in fact more like fish hooks when compared with the normal two-barbed arrows that I've used in Scheme 1 to represent the movement of electron pairs. The question then arises, do such radicals indeed take part as reactive intermediates in organic reactions? And the answer is yes, they do. Most reactions which take place in the gas phase, a number of reactions in nonpolar solvents, and many reactions that are brought about by light, all of these are found to involve radical intermediates. Indeed, the most widespread man-made organic reaction of all, the burning of petroleum hydrocarbons in internal combustion engines, this is a typical radical reaction. The first experimental observation of a radical dates back to 1900. A chemist named Gomberg was then studying, as I've shown in Scheme 3, the reaction of chlorotriphenylmethane with finely divided metallic silver in the absence of air and in the inert solvent benzene. What could be happening in this reaction, bearing in mind that the metallic silver has electrons available? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 4, an electron provided by the silver pulls out one of the electrons from the carbon-chlorine bond, thus forming silver chloride. This silver chloride precipitates out, leaving behind in the benzene solution a triphenyl-methyl group with the residual unpaired electron, a triphenyl-methyl radical, in fact. It's this radical that produces the yellow colour in the benzene solution. The unpaired electron of this radical can pair with the similar electron of another triphenyl-methyl radical, thus forming the colourless dimer. This was Gomberg's interpretation of what was taking place. He was quite right about the formation of the triphenyl-methyl radical, but he got the structural details of the dimer wrong, though this was only found out 70 years later, and it needn't concern us now in any case. It's been shown that an equilibrium is set up in the benzene solution between triphenyl-methyl radicals and this dimer. In fairly dilute solution, the equilibrium mixture contains only 2% of radical at room temperature, but about 10% at 80 degrees centigrade. The fact that there's any radical at all left, that it's not completely dimerized, is some measure of the very considerable stability of the triphenyl-methyl radical, as reflected in its reluctance to dimerize by electron pairing. The great majority of radicals are sufficiently reactive to dimerize as soon as they encounter another radical, and this dimerization is usually 100% complete. Interestingly enough, the next group of radicals to be studied were among the most unstable. It was discovered, as you can see in Scheme 5, that if organometallic compounds, such as tetramethyl lead, PbCH3 four times, were vaporized and the vapor carried down a heated tube in a stream of an inert carrier gas such as nitrogen, then a lead mirror was deposited on the inside wall of the tube just beyond the heated zone. A further interesting point was that if a second lead mirror had been deposited previously, a little further down the tube, then this second mirror was seen to disappear. What do you think is happening? While you're considering this, stop the tape. Well, in Scheme 6, you can see that heating decomposes tetramethyl lead to metallic lead, which deposits as a mirror on the cold wall of the tube. It also produces four methyl radicals, which are swept on down the tube by the stream of carrier gas. When these highly reactive methyl radicals arrive at the second, previously deposited lead mirror, they attack it, forming tetramethyl lead once again, which is swept away out of the tube in the stream of carrier gas. However, if the second lead mirror is deposited far enough downstream from the heated decomposition point, then this mirror no longer disappears. It remains unaffected no matter how much tetramethyl lead is passed in at the front end of the tube. Why is the second mirror now no longer attacked? While you think about this, stop the tape. As you can see in Scheme 7, two methyl radicals can react with each other by pairing their single electrons, thus forming a bond between them to yield the dimer, ethane. If the second lead mirror is deposited sufficiently far down the tube, all the very reactive methyl radicals in the gas stream will already have dimerized to ethane before they reach it. There aren't any reactive radicals left, so the lead mirror remains unscathed. Incidentally, lead tetraalkyls, such as this one, are very widely added to petrol to improve its performance in automobile engines, which they do through radical formation. An attendant disadvantage, however, is that this leads to pollution of the air by all the lead coming from car exhausts, so other ways of improving engine performance are being sought. Up to now, we've seen two quite different methods by which radicals have been generated. Reaction of chlorotriphenylmethane with finely divided metallic silver, and heat decomposition, or thermolysis, of tetramethyl lead. Both these methods are, in fact, fairly general. there is also another important method, photolysis, in which, as you can see in Scheme 8 with a molecule of chlorine, radicals are again generated by the fission of a covalent bond, the energy required to break the bond being supplied this time by radiation, most commonly ultraviolet radiation. All three of these methods, thermolysis, photolysis, and reaction with finely divided metals, are actually used in the laboratory to generate radicals. But there is often a preferred method for a particular case. For example, heating or thermolysis works quite well with tetramethyl lead. This is because the carbon-lead bond is a weak one, and the energy required to break it is thus quite low, in fact, only about 140 kilojoules per mole. This much energy can be provided, and the bond thereby broken, by heating to not much above 100 degrees centigrade. Similar temperatures are high enough to generate alkyl radicals from other metal alkyls, because the carbon-metal bond in these two is generally quite a weak one. By contrast, the chlorine-chlorine bond in the chlorine molecule is quite a strong one, and requires the input of nearly 250 kilojoules per mole to break it, which corresponds to a temperature of several hundred degrees centigrade. However, the characteristic radiation emitted by a mercury vapor lamp is capable of providing an energy input of up to 472 kilojoules per mole, which is considerably more than is required to break the chlorine-chlorine bond. It is, therefore, generally much easier and more convenient to generate chlorine radicals in the laboratory by photolysis with a mercury vapor lamp rather than by heating. Another weak bond that is broken readily at reasonable temperatures is the oxygen-oxygen or per-oxy bond. In Scheme 9, I've shown the thermal fission of benzoyl peroxide. This requires only 125 kilojoules per mole, and bond breaking occurs at temperatures as low as 80 to 100 degrees centigrade. There is, however, a further reaction that can take place at this temperature after initial formation of the benzoyl oxy radicals. What could this reaction be? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 10, thermal decarboxylation can take place to yield carbon dioxide and a phenyl radical. This decarboxylation is quite difficult to avoid, and thermal decomposition of benzoyl peroxide is in fact often used to generate phenyl rather than benzoyl oxy radicals. Another bond that can be broken quite readily by photolysis, as shown in Scheme 11, is the carbon-nitrogen bond in an azo-alkane. This bond is a strong one, but part of the energy required for its breaking is provided by energy released in the formation at the same time of that extremely stable species, a molecule of nitrogen. Thermolytically, however, this bond breaking is quite difficult to bring about, and the azoalkane in Scheme 11 is found to be stable up to 200 degrees centigrade. But if a suitable substituent is introduced, such as the cyano group in Scheme 12, then thermolytic fission can be made to take place much more readily. Indeed, the azo compound in Scheme 12 is already 50% converted into radicals after 5 minutes at only 100 degrees centigrade. The cyano group has this effect because it's able to stabilize the developing radical as it's being formed. How does it do this? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 13, the cyano group stabilizes the developing radical and thereby makes its formation easier through delocalization of the unpaired electron over its carbon-nitrogen triple bond. Decomposition of peroxides and of azo compounds, whether thermolytic or photolytic, is widely used to generate radicals in solution. Not so much as sources of these particular radicals themselves, but, as you can see in Scheme 14, because the reactive radicals generated initially can then be used to attack other suitable species, thereby generating new radicals that are not themselves obtainable directly. Another method of radical formation that we've already seen involve the action of silver metal on chlorotriphenylmethane. But metal ions can also be used to generate radicals. The requirement is that these ions should be capable of one electron transfers. A well-known example of this type is shown in Scheme 15. What name would you give to a reaction of this general type? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, it's a redox reaction. The iron 2 reduces a molecule of hydrogen peroxide to form a hydroxide ion plus a hydroxyl radical, and itself becomes oxidized to iron 3 in the process. An aqueous solution of hydrogen peroxide, to which iron 2 sulfate has been added, is known as Fenton's reagent, and is used as an easily generated source of hydroxyl radicals. This solution of Fenton's reagent acts as an oxidizing agent. This is because the major reaction of a hydroxyl radical, as you can see in Scheme 16, is abstraction of a hydrogen atom from any suitable species that may be within reach, such hydrogen atom abstraction being, of course, an oxidation. As I've also shown in Scheme 16, the new radicals generated by hydrogen atom abstraction can then dimerize by pairing of their single electrons, and under suitable conditions, the overall reaction can actually be used preparatively. Radicals can also be generated through a redox reaction that involves electrolysis. As you can see in Scheme 17, electrolysis of an alkali metal salt of a carboxylic acid results in the carboxylate anion giving up an electron at the anode to form the corresponding carboxylate radical. What do you suppose might happen next to this radical? While you think about it, stop the tape. As you can see with the specific example shown in Scheme 18, decarboxylation takes place immediately after discharge at the anode, and the new radicals so obtained then dimerize to yield a stable long-chain molecule. This reaction, which is called the Kolbe electrolytic synthesis, is sometimes useful preparatively, as shown by the entirely acceptable yield of the complex dicarboxylic ester obtained in Scheme 18. Now let's turn to a different point. An interesting question about radicals that have their unpaired electron located on a carbon atom is what shape are they? These radicals have three other atoms or groups bonded to this central carbon atom, and, as you can see from Scheme 19, they could be either planar, like a carbonium ion, with the unpaired electron in a p orbital, or pyramidal, like a carbanion, with the unpaired electron in an sp3 hybrid orbital. Evidence about the shape of radicals comes mainly from spectroscopic measurements, and as shown in Scheme 20, these measurements demonstrate that simple alkyl radicals, such as CH3, are planar or very nearly so, as is CCl3, but that CH2OH is significantly bent out of the planar shape, while CF3 is definitely pyramidal. It's been found that, in general, simple radicals adopt the planar shape, but some bending out of this shape seems to present no great problem, and indeed occurs fairly frequently. When the carbon atom carrying the unpaired electron in a radical is conjugated, with a double bond or with a benzene ring, as in the example shown in Scheme 21, we find that a planar shape is virtually forced on the radical. Why should this be so? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 22, delocalization of the unpaired electron with consequent stabilization of the radical can occur only if the unpaired electron is in a p orbital, which can overlap with the p orbitals of the rest of the conjugated system, if the radical is planar, that is. In this connection, the shape of the triphenyl methyl radical, C6H5 3C, in Scheme 23 is of some interest. This is because its shape determines the extent to which delocalization of the unpaired electron with consequent stabilization can occur. As you can see in Scheme 23, maximum stabilization requires that all 19 carbon atoms in this radical should be in the same plane. Only then can maximum p-orbital overlap occur. In actual fact, this radical turns out to be propeller-shaped, with the three benzene blades angled at about 30 degrees out of the common plane. What could be operating to force this radical out of the overall planar state? The shape we would have expected it to take up for maximum stabilization. While you think about all this, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 24, the answer is hydrogen atoms. Hydrogen atoms in the ortho positions of adjacent benzene rings are sufficiently close to each other that they can be accommodated only if the benzene rings are twisted out of the overall planar shape. This hydrogen-hydrogen interaction would be at a minimum when the rings were each at right angles to the plane of the paper. But then there could be no orbital overlap at all, and hence no stabilization through delocalization. The 30-degree angling of the blades in the propeller shape clearly represents a compromise, in which hydrogen-hydrogen interaction is substantially reduced, while at the same time significant stabilization through delocalization is still retained. Now let's turn to the question of how the ease or difficulty of forming radicals is related to their structure. Take a look at Scheme 25, and while you're doing so, stop the tape. As you can see from Scheme 25, some idea of the relative ease of formation of a series of rather similar radicals can be gained from comparing the strengths of the relevant carbon-hydrogen bonds in the corresponding alkanes. The weaker this bond is, the more readily will the radical be formed. The two sequences shown in Scheme 25 do in fact also reflect the relative stability of the radicals so obtained. But there's another feature that may also be involved in determining the overall stability of a radical. As you no doubt remember, a common fate that overtakes radicals is for two of them to pair their single electrons, thus forming a bond between the two radicals. Dimerization, in fact. So the more stable a radical is, the less ready it should be to undergo such dimerization. An interesting example of a very stable radical is the one shown in Scheme 26, which, as it happens, is dark blue in colour. This species is found not to dimerize at all, but to remain 100% in the radical form, not only in solution, but in the solid state as well. Can you suggest any reason why this radical should be so stable in terms of not forming the corresponding dimer? While you think about it, stop the tape. The answer, as shown in Scheme 27, lies in the substituents in the benzene ring. These Me3C groups are very large indeed, and the pair of them in the two ortho positions adjacent to the oxygen atom thus form an extremely effective barrier to the approach of another radical. The result is that dimerization via the oxygen atom is completely prevented. The unpaired electron on the radical can, as shown, be delocalized, specifically to the ortho and para positions of the benzene nucleus, but the very large Me3C groups attached here successfully prevent dimerization through these positions as well. We've now talked quite a bit about radicals, but we haven't as yet said anything about how we can actually detect their presence. By far the most effective method of doing so makes use of the fact that the presence of an unpaired electron confers specific magnetic properties on the radical that contains it. Exposure of a radical with such magnetic properties to an external magnetic field results in the generation of a detectable absorption spectrum. This technique is known as electron spin resonance, or ESR, spectroscopy. Under the most favorable conditions, it can be used to detect radicals present in concentrations as low as 10 to the minus 8 molar. Difficulties can arise, however, because many radicals have only an extremely short life. This can make it difficult to maintain a high enough concentration of the radical for long enough to record its spectrum. But this difficulty can be overcome in several ingenious ways. One of these is to generate the radical continuously, in a reaction carried on just outside the ESR spectrometer, pumping the solution containing the radical, as it's formed, rapidly and directly through the sample cell of the instrument. A sufficient local concentration of radical can thus be maintained for as long as the reaction mixture is pumped through. This continuous flow needs to be fairly rapid, however, and the major disadvantage of this method is that it uses up quite large quantities of starting materials, which may be expensive or require a great deal of time and trouble to make. The other major way of overcoming the problem of the short life is to prolong it, or even if only at second hand. This can be done, as shown in Scheme 28, by generating the short-lived radical in the presence of a suitable species, in this case a nitroso compound, with which the radical combines very readily, thereby generating a new radical. The species added is chosen so that it leads to the formation of a new radical which is much longer lived than the original one, and can thus be detected by ESR spectroscopy without difficulty. This ingenious technique is called spin trapping. What we're generally trying to do in detecting radicals is to find out whether a particular reaction proceeds through one or perhaps more radical intermediates. ESR spectroscopy will certainly tell us this, but only, of course, if we have an ESR spectrometer at our disposal. Fortunately, there are a number of simpler tests that we can use to tell us if a particular reaction proceeds via a radical pathway. One of these tests involves consideration of the actual conditions under which the reaction takes place. Quite early on in our discussion, I mentioned something about the particular conditions that favoured radical reactions. Do you remember what these conditions were? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, reactions that take place only when irradiated with visible or ultraviolet light, or reactions that are greatly accelerated by such irradiation, these often proceed via a radical pathway. In Scheme 29, I've shown the formation of HCl from chlorine and hydrogen. Here, irradiation operates by causing homolytic bond fission, in this case in a chlorine molecule, thereby forming two highly reactive chlorine radicals, which then set the real reaction off. Another way of detecting whether a radical intermediate is formed during the course of a particular reaction is shown in Scheme 30. This involves carrying out the reaction in which we are interested in the presence of phenylethene or styrene, which is known to polymerize very readily in the presence of radicals. This polymerization to polystyrene is very rapid, so if any radical intermediates are formed in the course of the main reaction, then polystyrene will be detectable almost immediately after this main reaction has started. Here, we've used polystyrene formation as a test for detecting a possible radical reaction pathway. But the actual production of polystyrene is itself a reaction of considerable industrial importance. Supposing you wanted to polymerize styrene, how exactly would you go about setting the reaction off? While you think about this, stop the tape. Well, in the light of Scheme 30, you would need to add some radicals to the styrene, but reactive radicals can't normally just be poured out of a bottle. What you would have to do is to add to the styrene some substance that can be converted, under very mild conditions, into the necessary radicals. Can you remember from our previous discussion any examples of substances like this? While you think back, stop the tape. In Scheme 31, I've listed two compounds that we looked at earlier, one a peroxide and the other an azo compound, both of which yield plenty of radicals on quite gentle heating. Compounds such as these that can be used as sources of radicals to induce polymerization are called initiators. Now, there's a fairly obvious but very important point about what happens when a radical reacts with an ordinary covalent molecule. This is something that you've almost certainly noticed for yourself, but that I haven't specifically mentioned. We saw it happening in styrene polymerization in Scheme 30, and we saw it happening also in spin trapping in Scheme 28. What is this important point? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 32, when a radical reacts with any ordinary covalent species, a new radical is always produced. The significant point is that with this new radical, we still have a highly reactive species that is itself capable of carrying on the reaction. The implications of this are apparent in Scheme 30 in the polymerization of styrene. A single initiator radical is able to effect the conversion of a large number of molecules of starting material into product. That's the end of the first side of this cassette. Please now wind the tape onto the end, and then turn the cassette over for the second side. With a background of this very important property of initiator radicals, of a single radical being able to effect the conversion of a large number of molecules of starting material into product, let's now take a rather more detailed look at a fairly familiar reaction, the addition of chlorine to a carbon-carbon double bond. Have a look at this reaction in Scheme 33. While you're doing so, stop the tape. In Scheme 33, I've written out this reaction with tetrachloroethene as the starting material in a way that emphasizes the highly characteristic effect of an initiator radical on a suitable reaction. The initiators here, chlorine radicals, which are of course atoms of chlorine, these are produced photochemically by irradiation of chlorine molecules. One of these chlorine atoms adds to the carbon-carbon double bond in tetrachloroethene, converting it into a new pentachloroethyl radical. This radical, in turn, reacts with a further molecule of chlorine to yield the expected overall addition product plus a new chlorine atom. This new chlorine atom can then repeat the whole cycle, and so it goes on. In each cycle, a molecule of chlorine and a molecule of tetrachloroethene are used up, and a molecule of addition product is formed. All these repeated cycles of conversion, molecules of starting material being converted into molecules of product, result from the influence of a single initiator atom of chlorine. Such a continuing cyclic process is called a chain reaction. In theory, the absorption of a single quantum of radiation, which will produce two chlorine atoms, each of which can start its own chain reaction, this should be quite enough to convert all the molecules of starting material into product. In fact, each single quantum of radiation absorbed leads to the conversion of several thousand molecules of starting material into product, but not to the conversion of the whole lot. What could be stopping the individual chain reactions while there's still starting material left? While you think about this, stop the tape. As you can see in Scheme 34, the answer is collision between two radicals. Each of these radicals is then lost from its chain reaction, and no new radical is generated to take its place. By such a collision, not one but two chain reactions are thus terminated simultaneously. Such termination will happen only very rarely while plenty of starting material molecules are still available. This is because collision between a radical and a molecule of starting material will then be statistically so much more frequent than a collision between two radicals. But in the later stages of the reaction, when the concentration of starting material has become very much lower, collision between two radicals will then happen very much more often. It's found in practice that the major chain termination reaction is reaction 2 in Scheme 34, collision between two pentachloroethyl radicals. Interestingly, it's found that the overall addition of chlorine is considerably inhibited by the presence in the system of oxygen from the air. This happens because the structure of the molecule of oxygen, as you may know, is such that it has no less than 2 unpaired electrons. It's a diradical, in fact. An oxygen molecule, as you can see in Scheme 35, can thus react with a pentachloroethyl radical to form a new peroxyradical. This particular peroxyradical is not, however, very reactive. In fact, it's not reactive enough to carry on the chain reaction, which is thus terminated. That it's largely pentachloroethyl radicals with which any oxygen in the system reacts is demonstrated, as shown in Scheme 35, by the formation of trichloroethanoyl chloride when any oxygen is present. The addition of halogens to carbon-carbon double bonds can also proceed by a polar, non-radical pathway, without then any need for photochemical activation. Thus, bromine will still add to a carbon-carbon double bond in the dark by a polar pathway, but addition is then very much slower than it is in sunlight when a radical pathway is followed. Why is it that addition is so much faster in sunlight? While you think about this, stop the tape. Well, it's so much faster because in sunlight, the radical pathway of addition is a chain reaction. Energy from the sunlight converts bromine molecules into bromine atoms, each of which can initiate a chain reaction, just like those with chlorine atoms in Scheme 34. Little or no further input of energy is required to maintain each chain reaction, which thus proceeds extremely rapidly until terminated by radical dimerization. By contrast, the polar pathway in the dark, like the great majority of organic reactions, requires energy input to be repeated for each molecule of starting material converted into product. Addition by this pathway is thus very much slower. One of the most characteristic features of radical chain reactions is indeed their rapidity. Another familiar reaction of a carbon-carbon double bond is addition of hydrogen bromide, as shown in Scheme 36 with ethene. This addition, like that of bromine, can proceed either by a radical or by a polar pathway. As you can see in Scheme 37, when HBr is added to a non-symmetrical alkene, such as propene, then the product from the radical pathway is found to be 1 bromopropane, while the product from the polar pathway is the isomeric 2 bromopropane. This difference arises because initial attack on the double bond is by a different species in each of the 2 pathways. It's been found, as shown in Scheme 38, that for the polar pathway, initial attack is by H plus a proton, while for the radical pathway, initial attack is by Br, an atom of bromine. What intermediate would you expect to get from attack by each of these species on propene? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, in Scheme 39, as you can see, polar attack by H plus could lead to 2 different carbonium ion intermediates, one a primary carbonium ion and the other a secondary one, while radical attack by Br could lead similarly to 2 different radical intermediates, one a primary radical and the other a secondary one. We've already seen that secondary radicals are more stable than primary, and the same is true, only more so, for carbonium ions. Thus, each pathway, polar and radical, will lead to the more stable secondary intermediate. What's then going to happen next to each of these different secondary intermediates? While you think about it, stop the tape. In Scheme 40, you can see that in the polar pathway, addition to the carbonium ion intermediate of Br minus, the bit left over from the original HBr, leads to the expected 2 bromopropane, while in the radical pathway, the radical intermediate attacks a further molecule of HBr, abstracting a hydrogen atom from it, thus forming the expected 1 bromopropane. At the same time, a further atom of bromine is also generated, which can repeat the reaction cycle with a further molecule of propene. this whole cycle being repeated in the now familiar chain reaction until ultimately terminated. But you may be saying, why in the radical pathway in Scheme 39 do we think that it's Br, an atom of bromine, that attacks the propene molecule initially? Why shouldn't it be H, an atom of hydrogen, instead? This results from the way in which the overall radical pathway is usually initiated, through the agency of initiator substances such as peroxides. These peroxides readily yield peroxyradicals, which are themselves the real initiators. As you can see in Scheme 41, these peroxyradicals could, in theory, generate a new radical from HBr in either of two different ways, as in 2 to produce Br, or as in 3 to produce H. In fact, the energetics of the two alternative reactions are such as to lead wholly to reaction 2 in Scheme 41, the generation of an atom of bromine. In preparative terms, the addition of HBr to propene can be exploited to yield either 1 or 2 bromopropane as desired. To obtain the 1 bromo compound, we just add peroxides as initiators to promote the very rapid chain reaction of the radical pathway. Getting the 2 bromo compound is not quite so easy, however. This is because an alkene, on standing, will gradually absorb oxygen from the air, thereby itself being partially converted into a peroxide. The alkene starting material thus already contains a built-in radical initiator, with the result that on exposure of this alkene to HBr, the 1 bromo compound is formed extremely rapidly via the radical chain reaction, even though no external peroxide initiator has been added. This internal triggering of the radical pathway of HBr addition to give a product different from the expected product of polar addition is called the peroxide effect. The operation of this peroxide effect can be avoided by very careful purification of the alkene prior to reaction with HBr. Any accumulated peroxides will then be removed, but this can in practice be quite difficult to achieve. It's much easier to add to the alkene prior to its exposure to HBr substances that will themselves react particularly readily with radicals. These substances, which are referred to as inhibitors, mop up all the peroxyradicals in the alkene. Compounds like phenols are particularly good at this. Once the peroxyradicals have been removed and the radical pathway thus blocked, the way is now clear for the slower polar pathway of HBr addition to operate exclusively and thereby producing 2-bromopropane. And this polar pathway can be further promoted by carrying out the reaction in solvents of high polarity. In Scheme 42, I've quoted the heats of reaction for both steps of the radical pathway for addition of HBr to ethene, and I've also quoted the corresponding values for HF, HCl, and HI. On the basis of these values, would you expect these other hydrogen halides to add to ethene by a radical pathway also? While you think about this, stop the tape. Well, as you can see in Scheme 42 for HBr, both steps of the radical reaction are exothermic, which is hardly surprising as we already know that HBr addition proceeds very rapidly by a radical pathway. For HF, step 2 is highly endothermic, reflecting the strength of the HF bond and the consequent difficulty in breaking it. An HF addition is found not to proceed via a radical pathway. For HCl, step 2 is again endothermic, though not to so great an extent as for HF, while for HI, it's step 1 that is endothermic, reflecting the fact that the energy gained in forming a weak carbon-iodine bond is not as great as the energy required to break the carbon-carbon double bond in the original alkene. In practice, a few radical additions of HCl are known, but none of HF or of HI. All 4 hydrogen halides will add by a polar pathway, however, for which the energy values of the separate steps are somewhat different from those quoted in Scheme 42 for the radical pathway. The most important and by far the most thoroughly investigated radical addition reaction is undoubtedly the polymerization of alkenes, of which we have already seen an example in the polymerization of styrene. Now, however, taking ethene as our example, the overall polymerization process is summarized in Scheme 43. While you study it, stop the tape. Peroxides or azo compounds are commonly added to the alkene to provide the necessary initiator radicals. But alkenes which have been stored for some time may, as we've already seen, absorb oxygen from the air, thereby forming sufficient peroxides to effect premature and uncontrolled polymerization. To prevent this from occurring, alkenes are generally stored containing an inhibitor, such as a suitable phenol, to mop up any peroxide radicals formed in this way. When we then want polymerization to start, peroxides or azo compounds are added as usual, but in a quantity more than sufficient to react with any residual inhibitor still present. There will thus be a pause, called an induction period, after adding the initiator, while this reacts with the residual inhibitor before polymerization proper can begin. The propagation step in Scheme 43 is often very rapid, and polymers may be formed containing hundreds or even thousands of alkene units in their long chain molecules. Termination, as in Scheme 43, then commonly occurs by the interaction of two growing molecules of polymer. But as well as this dimerization process, interaction between the growing polymer molecules can, as shown in Scheme 44, also take the form of hydrogen atom abstraction. This interaction terminates one growing polymer molecule, but results in the formation of a new radical center somewhere along the other growing molecule. Further growth of this second molecule can now take place at the new as well as at the old radical center, resulting in the formation of a branched polymer molecule. Such branching can have a very considerable effect on the physical and mechanical properties of the final polymer, making it, for example, harder and less easy to cut. The length of the individual molecules of a polymer also influences its properties. The length of polymer molecules can, however, be controlled in a number of ways. In the light of what has been said to date, can you perhaps suggest one way in which this molecular length could be influenced? While you think about it, stop the tape. Well, one way is by increasing or decreasing the proportion of initiator added to the alkene at the start to trigger polymerization, thus increasing the quantity of initiator added to a given amount of alkene will increase the number of growing polymer molecules. Termination thus becomes more probable relative to continued propagation, and the individual molecules of polymer are thus likely to be shorter. And clearly, the reverse will also be true. The less initiator, the longer the molecules. The length of polymer molecules can also be controlled by the addition of what are called chain transfer agents. These, as shown in Scheme 45, are compounds such as thiols, RSH, which undergo ready abstraction of a hydrogen atom by a growing polymer molecule. This growing molecule is thereby terminated, but a further radical, RS, has been generated, which is itself capable of initiating a new polymer molecule from the original alkene. Neither of the two polymer molecules thus produced is then as long as the original one would have been had it not been terminated in this way. But, and this is important, the overall rate of conversion of alkene into polymer has not been slowed down. The essential character of the reactions we have studied to date has been radical addition to carbon-carbon double bonds, but this is by no means the only type of reaction that proceeds by a radical pathway. Another very common type of reaction is the one shown in Scheme 46, the photochemically initiated chlorination of an alkane. While you study it, stop the tape. This is, in overall terms, a substitution or displacement reaction. The hydrogen atom originally attached to R in the alkane being displaced by chlorine. But, as you can see from the detailed reaction scheme, the reaction is not a direct displacement of hydrogen by the photochemically generated chlorine atom. Looking at the reaction scheme, you can see that this is again a chain reaction, in which step 2 produces a new chlorine atom that can initiate a further cycle, and so it goes on. In the chlorination of methane, CH4, it's found that each chlorine atom generated photochemically leads to the conversion of about 1 million molecules of methane into chloromethane before that particular repeating cycle is terminated. Chlorination can also be initiated thermolytically, but the energy input needed to break the chlorine-chlorine bond in a molecule of chlorine is quite considerable. Thus, the rate of chlorination of ethane at 120 degrees centigrade in the dark is virtually undetectable. If, however, small traces of tetraethyl lead, PbEt 4 times, are introduced into the reaction mixture at this temperature, extremely rapid chlorination of the ethane then results. Why does this happen? While you think about it, stop the tape. As you can see in Scheme 47, at 120 degrees centigrade, tetraethyl lead is decomposed to yield ethyl radicals, which can then act as very effective initiators of the chlorination chain reaction. It's found, hardly surprisingly, that the rates of chlorination of differently sited hydrogen atoms in an alkane are not all the same. I've quoted some values for these relative rates in Scheme 48. These values reflect, going from left to right, decreasing strength of the carbon-hydrogen bond in the alkane and increasing stability of the resultant radical produced by hydrogen atom abstraction. Suppose we were to react 2-methylpropane, that's CH3 three times CH, with just enough chlorine to form only monochloroderivatives, what would you expect the composition of the product to be? While you work this out, stop the tape. As you can see in Scheme 49, there are two different monochloro products that can be obtained. The values I've quoted for relative rates in Scheme 48 might, at first sight, suggest that we ought to get these chloroderivatives in a ratio of 6.7 to 1 in favour of the 2-chloro compound. That would be about 87% of 2-chloro. In the actual experiment, however, we get only about 39% of 2-chloro. What have we neglected to take into account? While you think about this, stop the tape. In Scheme 50, I've written out the two alternative chlorination reactions once again, only this time I've underlined all the hydrogen atoms in the starting material, 2-methylpropane. I've done this to emphasise that while there is only one hydrogen atom whose displacement can lead to the 2-chloro derivative, there are no less than 9 alternative hydrogen atoms, the displacement of any one of which will lead to the 1-chloro derivative. We thus need to revise our calculation as shown in Scheme 50. While you study it, stop the tape. This now suggests the formation of approximately 43% of the 2-chloro compound, which is rather closer to the 39% that we actually obtained. Not altogether surprisingly, the proportions of the two different chloro compounds actually obtained is found to depend, to some extent at least, on the conditions under which the reaction is carried out. In Scheme 51, I've quoted heats of reaction for both steps of the chain reaction for halogenation of methane with each of the 4 halogens, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine. We already know that chlorination proceeds readily by the radical pathway. But what will happen with methane and each of the other halogens? While you think about this, stop the tape. Well, the values for fluorine reflect the weakness of the fluorine-fluorine bond in F2 and the strength of the hydrogen-fluorine bond in HF. In fact, fluorination is found to need no photochemical or other initiation, and the reaction can indeed be explosive. Bromination is generally a good deal slower than fluorination, as step one is now endothermic, while with iodine, step one is so highly endothermic that direct iodination of alkanes does not normally take place. The much lower reactivity of a bromine atom towards abstraction of hydrogen is demonstrated, as shown in Scheme 52, by much greater variation in relative rates of bromination of differently sited hydrogen atoms compared to the values for chlorination quoted in Scheme 48. Bromine, because it's less reactive, is much more selective in where it will attack. It's important to emphasize that the rates quoted are relative to methane as one for each series. The absolute rates of bromination of all alkanes are much slower than their rates of chlorination. Another important reaction that often starts with hydrogen abstraction is oxidation, and the specific case of the low-temperature oxidation of organic compounds by oxygen from the air involving a radical chain reaction is called autoxidation. The initial stage of autoxidation is commonly the one shown in Scheme 53, the conversion of RH into the hydroperoxide ROOH. Now, supposing we have a radical initiator RA available, and remembering that molecular oxygen, O2, is a diradical, can you write out a chain reaction for the conversion shown in Scheme 53? While you're doing it, stop the tape. In Scheme 54, I've written out a possible pathway. The intermediate peroxyradicals, ROO, are usually of relatively low reactivity, rather like O2 itself, and are thus highly selective in the positions from which they will then abstract a hydrogen atom. Thus, as you can see from the example shown in Scheme 55, there is preference for a hydrogen atom on a carbon adjacent to a benzene ring, a benzylic hydrogen, or for a hydrogen atom on a carbon adjacent to a double bond, an allylic hydrogen. This is because these carbon-hydrogen bonds are slightly weaker than those in a simple alkane, and the radicals formed from them by abstraction of a hydrogen atom are each then stabilized by delocalization of their unpaired electron. A hydrogen atom on the carbon adjacent to an ether linkage is also found to be prone to attack, and the peroxides so formed are highly explosive when heated. It's as well to remember this when evaporating an ethereal solution in the laboratory in order to recover a dissolved product, and particularly is this so if the ethereal solution has been allowed to stand exposed to the air before evaporation. If a particular hydrogen atom lacks any of these activating features, however, it will commonly be peroxidized at room temperature only if it's in a tertiary position. Other alkanes do undergo autoxidation at higher temperatures, however, and it's the radical chain reactions thereby initiated that are responsible for the very rapid, though controlled, combustion of petroleum hydrocarbons in the engines of motor cars and aircraft. Autoxidation is also responsible for destructive changes in very many organic compounds, particularly in materials containing unsaturated linkages. Thus, it leads to rancidity in fats and to the perishing of natural rubber. It can, however, also be taken advantage of. Thus, autoxidation is of importance in the hardening of oil-based paints, where unsaturated esters in the oil medium absorb oxygen from the air to form hydroperoxides. Ready decomposition of these hydroperoxides to peroxyradicals initiates polymerization in further unsaturated molecules, this resulting in the formation, on the surface of the paint, of a film of polymer which is stable and hence protective. In some cases, autoxidation may even be of preparative value, And one such example is the large-scale industrial preparation of phenol and propanone, both at the same time. As you can see in Scheme 56, the first step in this process involves air oxidation of the readily available hydrocarbon cumene to phenylpropane to its hydroperoxide, a reaction which can be carried out in very high yield. Treatment of this hydroperoxide with dilute acid then leads, by the detailed steps shown in Scheme 56, to the rapid formation of both phenol and propanone. These subsequent steps are not radical reactions, and I don't therefore propose to discuss them further. In this cassette, we've had time to discuss only a few of the interesting and often unusual reactions that involve radicals. If you now want to find out more about such reactions, you can obtain further information from Chapter 11 of the fourth edition of my Guidebook to Mechanism in Organic Chemistry.